Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
Well, later on this week, family and friends of the late politician Brian Lenehan Jr. will mark a decade since his death. The former finance and justice minister and son of a Fianna Fáil Taoiseach presidential candidate died from pancreatic cancer at the age of just 52. Brian Lenehan had resigned his office just months before after two tumultuous years at finance, overseeing the bank guarantee, a string of austerity budgets and the EU IMF bailout. Throughout the period, he struggled with severe illness, and now 10 years on, his friends are fundraising to support research into the treatment of pancreatic cancer, which affects hundreds of people every year. And among them is Rory Montgomery, a friend of Brian's since they were students together in the 1970s. Rory is a former senior diplomat and ambassador who was involved in the negotiations for both the Good Friday Agreement and Brexit. Rory Montgomery, good morning and welcome to our studio.
Good morning, Miriam. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much on this beautiful morning. Thanks so much. We're going to talk a lot about Brian. First of all, though, I mean, you've been writing a lot since you retired about Anglo-Irish relations and the North. How would you assess right now, Rory, the state of Anglo-Irish relations, I suppose, in the wake of Brexit?
Well, I think everybody would agree that in and around the time of the Queen's visit to Ireland and President Higgins' state visit to Britain, that relations had never been better. But Brexit essentially blew up the entire edifice, and relations have, if anything, got stickier in the period since. And I think fundamentally, Brexit was always bound to put a great strain on relationships between Britain and Ireland and within Northern Ireland, as well as between Britain and Europe, of course. Mm. But at the same time, I think we have a British government at the moment, which sort of pains me to say this, is probably the most ill-informed and most reckless and in a way even frivolous in its approach to Northern Ireland. It's acted in a way which I think makes it very hard to trust it. And I think that's a fundamental problem in its negotiations and discussions with the EU at the moment. That said, I mean, Britain will remain Ireland's closest neighbour. It's our most important partner still in economic and other ways. Huge range of human connections. So we've no alternative but to make the relationship work. And I know that Micheál Martin and Simon Coveney and others are determined to do that, but it's a bit of an uphill battle at the moment.
And interestingly, you know, I get to, say, interview even Edwin Poots the other night, or we get to interview the people up front, but it's the civil servants, it's actually the people like you in the background who negotiate, do all the groundwork for things like the Good Friday Agreement. Will that relationship stay strong? Like, are the civil servants still strong, despite whoever's running the different governments?
Well, I think you maybe perhaps exaggerate slightly the role of civil servants, because in the end, it's political leadership that counts above all. I mean, in the Bertie Ahern, Tony Blair relationship, but even before that, John Major and Albert Reynolds, and David Cameron and Enda Kenny actually had quite a good relationship as well. No, the civil servants will continue to work together, as they always have, of course. And I think, though, a problem is, especially on the British side, that there often isn't very clear leadership. And moreover, of course, the fact that we're no longer meeting together in the corridors in Brussels and around the table in Brussels eliminates a huge amount of contact. I mean, even in my time in and around EU affairs, I would have got to know, you know, British officials who went on to do really, you know, important jobs elsewhere in the system. And those kind of connections are now severed. So I think the relationship will remain professional as it has to, but the lack of political guidance at the top level is what's disappointing.
Now, tell me about yourself, for my listeners, Rory, about your family, where you grew up and your parents.
Sure. Well, I was born in Dublin and brought up here. My parents are both originally from the north, my mother from Belfast and my father from County Antrim. And they both came to Dublin, in fact, over 70 years ago. I hope they're listening to the show. I'll be seeing them for a cup of coffee later on.
Good morning to them both.
Yeah. And they both went to school in Belfast, and they both got scholarships to go to Trinity, which was quite common for Northerners in those days. And in fact, I had a family connection with Trinity, or my father did, because his aunt, my great-aunt Jean, held the wonderfully named title of Lady Superintendent of the Kitchen from 1919 to 1949, which was head of catering, essentially. So that was maybe a reason to go. And he remembers going down at the age of seven to see his father was a teacher, but also wrote some plays. And one of the plays was put on at the Abbey Theatre. And he remembers visiting Trinity and meeting his aunt on that occasion. So they've spent all their lives in Dublin pretty well since then, a couple of years in London, but they came back to Dublin not long before I was born and have lived here ever since.
And they were Presbyterians, from a Presbyterian background?
Absolutely, yes. They were both brought up as Presbyterians. My mother used to have to go to church twice a day on a Sunday and to Sunday school as well. I think godless Dublin maybe made them drift away from the faith. So I went to Protestant schools, national school and secondary school, and certainly I would have been culturally part of, you know, Protestant South Dublin, I suppose, but we were never religious.
Were you aware of that, actually, Rory, growing up in Dublin, you know, like the child of Northern Presbyterians? Were you conscious that you were different, that you were Protestant?
I think not in a very strong way. I mean, the bizarre thing was that, as I say, Protestant South Dublin, there were enough Protestants in South Dublin to sort of sustain a kind of ecosystem, if you know what I mean. You know, whether it was schools or scouts or local tennis club or whatever it might be. I suppose I was always aware that there were, you know, things which Catholic neighbours were doing, and their first Holy Communion or so on and so forth, which we weren't aware of. And when I look back, you know, it was very much a sort of quite an Anglo-centric life. I mean, in terms of, you know, watching the BBC, listening to the BBC, reading British comics. Of course, many kids from all kinds of backgrounds lived on that. But it was a bit different. And I suppose that when the Troubles began in the North, I would have been, 10 or 11. And we would always have gone up regularly to visit family, because all my relations still live up north. And we would have been aware, certainly, of the problems in a way which maybe others weren't. But, you know, I had no idea of, for example, questions of discrimination and so on in Northern Ireland. No awareness of that, because my relations were all very nice, decent, non-political kind of people.
Mm. Can you remember the first time you met Brian Lennon?
Absolutely, yes. It was the first week in our first year in Trinity, October 1977. In those days, life was very civilised. The term began on about the 20th of October, and it was Freshers' Week. And we were introduced by the well-known writer and journalist Tom Dooherly, who was, Tom had been in Brian's class in Belvedere College, and he was then in my class in history, and we met, and we just hit it off right away, as people do at that age. When you're 17, 18, you know yourself, Miriam, at university, you know, many of the friends you make then are friends for the rest of your life, and even now I was just thinking about it, and I'd say the majority of my closest friends are people I met in that first year in Trinity, and Brian was from the very beginning, though, a tremendously important figure in the circle, and not just for me, but for lots of us.
But you remained such close friends right up until the end, didn't you?
Yes, we did. I mean, we had a very important couple of years. We lived together in rooms in Trinity. We were both foundation scholars, which is a sort of an award which is given to students who do a special exam. And that meant that we were able to, say, live for 2 years in the college, in conditions of some splendour, but also considerable squalor. the toilet was at the bottom of the stairs, and to have a shower, you had to walk across the cobblestones and so on. But we had 2 years then, and then later we remained great pals, and he was my best man. And of course, as time went on, I was abroad with the job, we both got married, he got into politics, etc. But we always kept in touch and would go out walking in the hills and meet with other friends. But then, of course, as you know, life kind of took a strange turn, because during that very difficult period as Minister for Finance, I was actually the Irish ambassador, permanent representative to the European Union. And so Brian would come out to meetings and I would accompany him to those meetings. But also he would come back to my house and stay with me. I mean, he wouldn't stay in a hotel with his own officials. He'd come back and we'd just, you know, sit there and chat, and he'd tell me what had happened, which was great, because the finance officials were often keen enough to keep the secret, top secret information to themselves, but he would tell me what was happening, and he'd chat about Irish politics, and then we'd talk about everything, you know. And this might go on for 2, 3, 4 hours. He'd like a bottle of wine, he would devour cheese, he was a great man for eating cheese, and then off we would go to bed at around 2 in the morning or whatever, and then he'd get up the next morning and we'd have another meeting, but the most important meeting was the one on the first day, so he would have focused on that.
And of course, he was minister, before we discuss his illness, at such a tough time in our history here in this country. Did you find those times he stayed with you, did you feel he was a man under pressure? I mean, you've known him since he was 17, 18. Like, did you feel that he felt the weight, the burden of it?
I think from time to time. I mean, I particularly remember, I mean, he famously said in an interview he gave, I think, to Dan O'Brien a month or two before he died, that he'd been at Baldonnell and felt that, I think it was, hell was at the gates, was how he put it. And I was at the other end of that flight to meet him when he came into Brussels. And this was the day the bailout itself was actually formally agreed. And he was really kind of exhausted and downcast. But he had amazing resilience and bounce, a sort of a family trait, perhaps, his father had it as well. So, in fact, what amazed me was not so much the pressure he was under, but the incredible kind of grace and energy with which he was able to bear it. And no matter how bad things were, he was always capable of, as I say, of bouncing back. I still remember vividly on that famous day of the bailout. And as I say, he was really exhausted. And then he had to pull himself together after a very difficult meeting to be interviewed by, I think it was Tony Connolly, Tony Connolly or Sean Whelan, I can't remember which. And afterwards he was joking and he said he recalled the famous medieval Spanish warrior El Cid, who was famously propped on a horse while dead to frighten the enemy. And he said, I'll be a bit like El Cid. He said, they can still use me, even in my present condition. He has a tremendous humour and resilience.
Yeah, he really did. When he became ill, when did you become aware of how ill Brian was?
Well, like about, I think, pretty much the entire country, through TV3 on St. Stephen's Day. Now, it was funny because St. Stephen's Day 2009, we would normally, pretty well always, with our other another great friend, David Lowe, and others, we would usually go for a pint, either on Christmas Eve or the day before, and strangely enough, he didn't reply to a couple of messages, which was unlike him, really. I mean, he wasn't always the most efficient with technology, but he would always get back. And then, you know, I'd read in the paper, I think, that he'd had a hernia operation. That was the kind of the line. But I was shocked. But he came to the house a day or two later, to my wife, Geraldine, and myself. And, you know, we talked for about 15 minutes about his illness and how it had been diagnosed and his attitude towards it. He was delighted. He'd got lots of letters of sympathy and so on. Even a few relics, he told me, had arrived in the post. But after about 15 minutes, he said, look, you know, that's enough about that. So we started chatting, as we did, and then he spotted this book I was reading, which was about the Italian front in World War I. And being Brian, of course, he'd read it. And so off we went, and he was chatting about, you know, Rommel's exploits in the Dolomites as a young officer and so on. That was how he was, you know. He had the most incredible mind, most incredible memory, but also a willingness to talk about everything and anything all the time. That was one of the things that really would have drawn people to him as a student. He just loved debating and arguing and chatting and spoofing on occasion, of course.
And he had a like whether it was Sean Whelan or Tony Connolly, and even on prime time, I was lucky enough to interview him, you know, a lot during those times. And he never played the self-pity card, even when he was so ill. I assume he was the same with you. He'd always be like, make sure this is a tough interview. I don't want any sympathy just because I'm ill.
Well, absolutely. And it was quite funny because on a couple of occasions when he was sick, when he was coming out to Brussels and the message would come through from his private office that we should give him a bit of space to rest. And so I remember on one occasion, it was, you know, towards the end of his time as minister, and the Fianna Fáil leadership election was coming up after Brian Cowan had stepped down. And anyway, I vacated my office in Brussels, which had a sofa in it so he could lie down on. But he wouldn't let me go. He beckoned me in. And then he got on the phone to a very well-known Irish journalist and started giving her his very unvarnished take on the state of Fianna Fáil politics. And he would rather do that than rest. So that's kind of how he was. Yeah, he was very professional. I mean, he really had a job to do. And if he couldn't have done it, he wouldn't have done it, if you know what I mean. And in the same way, he never held grudges. That was an extraordinary thing about him. I mean, he felt very sore, I think, at times about the way that Jean-Claude Trichet had handled matters as president of the ECB. He was very unhappy with Sarkozy and Merkel when their remarks at a G7 summit in Deauville kind of prompted what was the final run against Irish bonds. But he realised people were doing their jobs. And, you know, it was as it was. He was a real professional in that kind of way. And he'd have known that you were professionals doing your jobs too, you know.
He died, of course, on the 10th of June 2011. He was just 52, as I said. You gave a reading at his funeral, Rory. Can you recall what you read that day and why you felt it was a fitting choice for him?
Well, I mean, I was asked to read this particular choice. I think it's a reading which is probably more used at funerals maybe than any other. It's the whichever letter of St. Paul it is, I can't remember, but it's the famous one about having...
To Timothy, I think.
Timothy.
Yeah.
Having, you know, run the race and fought the good fight, and so on. And I remember as I was practicing reading it, in fact, I was in Brussels before coming back to the funeral. I was practicing, and about every time I came to finish the race and fought the good fight, I would kind of choke up. But I managed to get through it, luckily, on the day. It was quite funny because I had walked up and there, assembled below me, on the right-hand side you had family and friends, on the left-hand side you had the great and good of Irish society. So you had the President and the Taoiseach and Leader of the Opposition and lots of others. But anyway, I didn't disgrace myself on that occasion. And then, I say, the other great friend, David Lowe, also a Protestant from a Protestant background, Church of Ireland, West of Ireland background, he did the other reading. I still remember Mary O'Rourke turned around to us and said, "Lovely lessons, boys," she said, with a lesson being what Protestants call a reading.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. He's wonderful, aunt. Listen, you and his friends, his other friends, you're raising money now to support research into pancreatic cancer. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, for some years we had talked, a number of us had talked rather vaguely about doing something. Now, there's already a lecture in his honour every year in Trinity. So that was a particular avenue which was closed off. Also, there was a book about him, edited by Mary O'Rourke, indeed, the late Noel Whelan, and Brian Murphy, to which I contributed a chapter. These were reminiscences. So we were thinking, well, what would be appropriate? And then David Lowe, whom I mentioned earlier, who was the third member of our kind of hill-walking gang and who lived with Brian in Chatham Street for a couple of years after college, David was approached by the chairman of Cancer Trials Ireland, Jonathan Westrup, who suggested that there might be a gap for us in as much as they wanted to start a particular trial on a drug called paracalcitol. They needed some seed funding, if you like, to get it going, and wondered, might this be something we were interested in? So David and I talked about it with a number of other friends, and ultimately eight of us, who were friends from a variety of backgrounds, we got together, we formed a little sort of ad hoc group. We obviously talked to his widow, Patricia, and the children, Tom and Claire, to make sure that they were happy with what we were doing. And nobody wanted any fuss or anything very high profile, of course. But we simply got in touch with people who would have known Brian, whether family or neighbourhood friends, whether friends from college like ourselves, people from the law, people from politics. And people were extraordinarily kind of generous in their response. And we've now raised... We've pretty well reached the end of our fundraising, I think, although one person came through only this week. We've raised over €100,000 altogether. Now, we're privileged to be in the position to raise that kind of money, I suppose. And also, if you take into account tax relief, it increases the amount as well. But we're very pleased, and Cancer Trials Ireland have been able to go ahead now with this, the first phase of this particular project, which is wonderful. And I should say as well that since this started, we began talking about it a year or two ago, and then we were delayed a bit by COVID because we felt it wasn't really maybe the time to be asking people for money when we didn't know at the beginning how it would all work out. But we really started our push in November of last year, so we did well. But I became a member of the board of Cancer Trials Ireland. I think they're always eager to have a few non-medics on the board, and so I was asked if I would like to join it, so I have. And it's an absolutely fantastic organisation. It does wonderful work.
And it's great that it's in his memory as well. Yes. Now, how do you think, Rory, history will remember Brian Lenihan Jr.?
Well, of course, he will always be associated with these dreadfully difficult times. And no doubt about it, the financial crisis, economic crisis, came upon us, like a tsunami, really, in the autumn of 2008. And he was just recently Minister of Finance. And then, of course, as you said earlier, a series of very difficult budgets, and then the bailout in 2010, though personally I think there was really, at that point, no alternative to a bailout, given the inability we would have had to fund ourselves on the open markets. So he was there at a very difficult time. I think there would be a recognition that an awful lot of the really painful measures that had to be taken were taken by him in that government. In fact, more than well over half of the total sort of savings which had to be made were made under that Fianna Fáil government with Brian and Brian Cowan as Taoiseach. Both Brendan Howlan and Michael Noonan paid tribute to him at the first budget, in their budget speeches after the first budget, after he had died and they had taken office. So I think he'll be remembered for that, for having taken some very difficult decisions. But I hope he'd also be remembered for the example he gave of public service and patriotism at such a difficult time in his life. And, as I say, for his almost unfailing kind of good humour and bounce and cheerfulness. And I feel, I mean, who knows how life would have gone and afterwards, but, you know, I think he's someone whose loss into Irish politics was really immense. I've no doubt about that.
Roy Montgomery, thanks so much for coming in and being my guest this morning. We'll take a break. Lots of lovely reaction to Brian Lennon. I'll just bring you one. Tig says Brian Lennon was a true hero who put his country before himself, and he was an inspiration to us all in his resilience and commitment. Ireland should never forget him.